Welcome back to Question Medicine 2018. This is Andrew Bill, and I am down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Now, this episode we got going ahead is chocked full of ooey gooey goodness. Just gems and pearls are oozing everywhere you look. I even recorded this podcast two times. Yeah, I recorded it twice, and I never record anything twice because the first time I heard it, there just wasn't enough pizzazz with each article to really give you what you needed to know because, again, the information in this is just amazing. Probably, I would say, in my opinion, the podcast for me that has given me the most information in doing some of the research, or at least one of the top ones. So, without further ado, without any hesitation, any reservation, but let your mind rest because it's about to get a whole bunch of stimulation. Let's kick it off. Welcome back to Question Medicine 2018. I am Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And as I said in the intro, we're continuing this on about what I'm reading, what I'm thinking about. And this episode is no different. So let's get to it. See, first of all, I recently had to answer a question. One of the questions I had to answer was someone asking about coronary calcium testing. And this individual was saying, listen, I'm using coronary calcium testing because I want to use it to better risk stratify people. And then if I find that there's maybe something there, then I might convince them to go on statins. So I thought to myself, is this a good use of resources? So let's look into this a little bit closer. Coronary calcium testing costs about $100 to $400 depending where you look. So let's just say, for easy numbers, it's $250 per coronary calcium test. Now, if you go by thennt.com and the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, the number needed to treat for primary prevention and mortality with statins is infinity. It doesn't exist. But no benefit for mortality, and I'm assuming primary prevention, because if it's secondary prevention, if they've already had an event, then you shouldn't be getting a coronary calcium test to see if they meet criteria for statins, because they already meet criteria for statins, just by the fact that they've already had an event. Now, the number needed to treat is 1 in 217 to avoid a non-fatal heart attack, or MI, and 1 in 313 to avoid a non-fatal stroke. And remember, those are in patients whose initial baseline ASCVD risk was around 20% when you go back and look at those original studies. And I think most people that we are risk stratifying are much lower risk than that. These are not your, everyone, I guess, is not your 20% risk patient. I mean, I think this test, in the way that this provider was discussing it, is probably your 8%, your 9%, your 10%, not the 20%. Now, let's just assume that 75% of those who you convince to do a coronary calcium test are started on a statin. That means you have to get roughly 300 patients to do a coronary calcium test to prevent one non-fatal MI. $250 a pop means you're spending roughly $75,000 to prevent one heart attack. Even more money if you're looking at to prevent or avoid a non-fatal stroke. It's, again, not just the money. I mean, the money is a lot here, and that's probably more money than we spend on really anything. But it's the healthcare resources. It's the nurses, the techs, the radiologists. Because if they're doing a coronary calcium test for you, then they're not doing something else. Something else that could be more high yield for other patients elsewhere. So, is this worth it? I guess I'll let you decide. But what I'm failing to mention is that the numbers needed to harm, or every person that you start on a statin, for every 210 people you start on a statin, you are causing diabetes. Again, in the high risk 20% patients, causing diabetes is fine because statins outweigh the harms of a surrogate endpoint of a hemoglobin A1C in someone who was maybe only a ASCVD risk score of 8 or 7.5 or 9 or whatever it may be, this likely is not worth our time and really shouldn't be used, or at least I'm not using it in practice, and certainly not for that reason. And while we're on the topic of the heart, let's just continue right down that track. And right down that track actually leads me to Twitter, surprisingly enough. If you're not on Twitter, you should get on Twitter. And if you're on there and not following Dr. John Mandrola, then you should be. And in the last, 3 weeks or so, he has made two posts that I think are so noteworthy, so impressive, so amazing, so unbelievable. They deserve to be commented on. So here we go. Let's kick it off. One of them is a paper titled Harmonizing the Paradigm with the Data in Stable Coronary Artery Disease, a Review and Viewpoint. He was not the author of this one, but he posted it, and that's where I got it from. And I'm not going to give away everything. In fact, I'm going to give away the bottom line here, I guess, but I'm not going to give away all the details of this paper, because I would say it is one of the top five papers you must read in 2018. Unfortunately, I don't know if it's necessarily game-changing, because there's such a mindset around what is discussed in the paper. And what is discussed in the paper is stable angina and should we be going to cardiac cath. I think if you ask most cardiologists who are critical appraisals of the evidence, and I have one of those in my hospital, they'll tell you, I can say, I don't know if I'm doing much good when we do these things. But if you ask some of those that are not critical appraisers of the evidence, they may say, oh yeah, we're doing so much benefit when we go to cardiac cath for those individuals who have stable angina, or this stable angina equivalent. Again, this is not saying that cath or PCI is not beneficial for STEMI. I think we know that it is. But for stable angina, you need to go read this paper. Again, it is just, it's mind-blowing. It's eye-opening. That's number one. Now, number two is about the vest. About the vest. The reason I found this was a tweet, again, by Mandrola, tweeted a post. It said, how about, quote, in medicine's best test of efficiency, the randomized control trial, the wearable cardiac defibrillator failed to reduce the only endpoint it could plausibly reduce, sudden death, ? And he's talking about the vest trial, and this vest trial, and from what I read, and he has a Medscape post on this, I can put a link in the show notes, just click on it, go read it yourself. Again, it is phenomenal. And I don't know if it's actually out as a study yet, because I can't find it anywhere. I can just find his review of it from the cardiology conference in which it was released. However, here's what you need to know, is that basically the first randomized control trial that we actually have of wearable cardiac defibrillators, so the vest, is a multi-center randomized trial of patients with acute MI and an ejection fraction of less than 35%. In this trial, the patients are randomized in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive either medical therapy with or without this wearable cardiac defibrillator at hospital discharge. And then what happens? There is no difference in sudden death. No difference in sudden death between the two arms of the trial. Now, there was a difference in a secondary endpoint, which was total mortality. But as John brings up so well, you don't wear the vest to prevent all-cause mortality. You wear the vest to prevent sudden mortality. I don't give you the vest at discharge thinking that this is going to prevent car accidents. I give it to you thinking it's going to prevent the sudden death of some sort of arrhythmia. I don't give you the vest thinking it's going to prevent pneumonia and then death. No, I give you the vest thinking it's going to prevent a sudden death from some sort of arrhythmia that happens. So it's such a well-written piece. Again, I don't want to go through it all, but if you're not on Twitter, get on Twitter. And if you only go on there and just follow him, I think it's well worth it. So another one talking about the heart. let's continue on just a little bit and then transition all in one. Like a good assist and pass, like Stockton and Malone in their prime, let's move on. And that only seems fitting considering it's basketball playoff season. And of course, I'm talking about a paper titled Long-Term Outcomes Associated with ICD in Adults with Chronic Kidney Disease. And of course, ICD, we're talking about the implantable cardio defibrillators, and this is in JAMA Internal Medicine 2018. And what this found was basically in patients with chronic kidney disease and heart failure, the implantable, so not the vest, now we're really going the big deal here, the implantable cardio defibrillator did not lengthen survival, but was associated with excess risk for complications. So researchers in this study did a retrospective analysis of roughly 19,000 patients with chronic kidney disease, all had to have a GFR of less than 60, but could not be on dialysis. We're talking mean age here of 73 years old, and they had to have an ejection fraction less than 40%. The investigators then propensity matched or propensity scored about 4,000 patients without an ICD to about 1,500 patients with an ICD. Now, after follow-up of about 3 years, almost half of the patients have died. That's a huge proportion of the study that's already died after 3 years. But I think that just goes to show you that patients with heart failure just in general don't have the best prognosis. And we need to be aware of that when we're talking to any of these patients with an ejection fraction of less than 40. I think we all want to believe that if you have an ejection fraction less than 40 and we put an ICD in you, that you're going to live longer. It's going to be really beneficial. This is, we're getting you on, you're doing better. Here we go. However, this study does show that if your mean age is right about 70 and you've got an ejection fraction or a GFR less than 60, so CKD 3 or higher, then it did not affect the overall mortality, but was associated with a greater risk for heart failure hospitalizations and any cause mortality. And I would say quality of life. Having one of these pacemakers on or ICDs that accidentally goes off, it's not a benign thing. I think this is a good study, again, for the shared decision-making conversation of maybe this treatment isn't for you. And if that was transition basketball from cardiology to nephrology, now let's go full court press and just start talking about nephrology. And I am referring to a paper in the American Journal of Kidney Disease, March 2018, a paper titled Comparison of Patient Survival Between Hemodialysis and Peritoneal Dialysis Among Patients Eligible for Both Modalities. What did they find? Well, to sum it up, in the immediate term, or at least in the 1.5-year follow-up that this study had, survival was the same, whether you did peritoneal dialysis or hemodialysis. Now, this was a retrospective study of patients with end-stage renal disease. It took place in good old Canada, and they were looking at the survival among the patients. This was just over 2,000 patients, mean age 64 years old. They did a follow-up of 1.5 years, and what do you know? 24% of the patients died. However, the survival rates, whether you did peritoneal dialysis or hemodialysis, were very similar. I think this suggests, and not suggests, but you know, points to that. Listen, if all things being equal, if the patient can have home peritoneal dialysis, it's not only less expensive. We also know it's a better quality of life. People enjoy it more. I think that this should probably be offered more than it is. And why is it not offered? That is a million-dollar question, which brings me to my next article. It's a paper titled Dialysis Initiation and Mortality Among Older Vets with Kidney Failure Treated in Medicare versus the Department of Veteran Affairs. Because of where I work, this was near and dear to my heart, so let's dig into the details. This was a cohort study of just over 11,000 older vets with kidney failure. retrospectively evaluated these patients from either U.S. Medicare or the VA healthcare system, and the mean age, 67 years old. And they looked at charts between 2008 and 2011. The outcome that they were looking for was dialysis treatment and death within 2 years. Bottom line here is that despite more frequent initiation of dialysis, meaning they're getting dialysis a lot more often, patients who received care in Medicare were not more likely to survive compared with patients who received care in the VA. What does this mean? Well, again, what does it mean? I don't really know what it means. I think that some of it means patients who are on Medicare get dialysis sooner, but they're not having improved outcomes. And are they getting dialysis sooner because they need it, or are they getting dialysis sooner because there's some kind of financial incentive? I would like to think that it's not the latter. I would like to think that it's the former, but then you have to be saying that Medicare patients are different somehow than VA patients. And when you have a large patient population, I mean, even retrospectively, that those things kind of typically cancel out. And just like other high-cost intensive procedures, the likelihood of receiving dialysis treatment varies across different regions. Just like getting a cardiac cath varies across different regions. It depends if your hospital has catheterization. And this all, I think, points to the fact that there needs to be a better shared decision-making on when to start dialysis. And when is the right time to start dialysis? I put a little quote out there, or a little question to Twitter, and I asked, when do you start dialysis? I think the best response goes to NephroSparks, which said, stop looking at GFR. But then someone else responded and said, a good nephrologist knows when to start dialysis. The problem with a good nephrologist knows when to start dialysis is that this isn't hocus pocus magic. Almost, hopefully, nothing we do in medicine is, well, because I say we do it now, that's why we should do it. That sounds like infectious disease all over again. I say treat for 7 days because clearly 6 days wouldn't work. No, 6 days probably would work. I think it's the same with dialysis. There needs to be something a little bit more concrete that we can hang our hat on. And the editorial that was connected to this piece was so well written. If you want to like a copy of it, email me, andrewbilt@gmail.com. I'll be happy to send it your way. But basically, they go out and say, listen, and I quote, the timing of initiation of dialysis during the past 2 decades, 20 years, has been heavily influenced by opinion leaders. I'm just going to stop there. Opinion leaders, not hardcore evidence leaders or studies or randomized controlled trials. They also mentioned that since 2010, the GFR at the start of dialysis has remained stable or slightly declined, and that this probably is likely due to the only publication, or the publication in 2010, which was the only randomized clinical trial and timing of dialysis initiation, which did not show benefit of early initiation of dialysis when you compared a mean GFR of 7.2 versus a mean GFR of 9.8. And as much as I love nephrologists, this is far from a hard science. And anyone who thinks that it's a hard science, or it's a, hey, only nephrologists know when this is, I think we need to step back and say, we don't know, and we need better evidence. And this editorial, who was written by nephrologists, even says, maybe my favorite line in the whole piece was, so, while we await for more randomized clinical trials in this area, we should acknowledge that we currently do not fully know what the best trade-off is for each patient. Basically, they're saying, we need some humility here. We need more studies. We need more research because we don't really know it all. And I could not agree more. And it makes me question, have I pushed for dialysis in a patient which probably could have not had it? Or have I laid off on a patient that maybe came in a month or two later with uremic syndromes and probably should have had dialysis? Those are answers we'll never know. But I guess it's the lack of studies that leads me and others, and hopefully you, to keep questioning medicine. And I think that puts a wrap right about the 20-minute mark on this podcast. I'm going to end this podcast like I've ended every podcast before it. When I start to hear the music, I start to tune out just a little bit, and I say, until next time, keep the quest in questioning.